Tonight's show is sponsored by Recycled Processes, Inc.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings be upon you. Good evening. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago, Illinois. I'm your host, Olivia Richardson. Radio Islam is a live call and talk radio program airing every day from 6 to 7 p.m. Central, and we reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com. We can tap into all of our prior shows as well. This is a pre-recorded program tonight. To reach out to us on what you hear, catch us on social media at Radio Islam USA. To catch a recording of the show if you're listening to us on the radio, visit our SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/Radio Islam USA or check out our website at radioislam.com. We're throwing you an oldie but goodie back from 2015. Former Radio Islam host Imran Hussein talks with Peter Manso, an author, historian, and journalist who has curated an exhibit at the Smithsonian called Religion in America, which will be opening up this coming July 2017. The two talk about the history of Islam in America, with conversation focusing on a lost narrative of America's first Muslims.
To Radio Islam, a call and talk radio program here on 1450 AM. My name is Imran Hussein. It's been a while since I've been here, but I am back, and actually for a very special reason, because this is the last live show for our producer, Shireen Rahman, and we will be talking to her a little bit later in the show. But now we are actually going to turn our thoughts and analysis on a very interesting topic. Who are America's first Muslims, and why are they rarely acknowledged? And in addition to that, I'm very curious to know, as well as many others, how is history written in this country when it comes from an educational perspective? What do the kids learn about not just the ethnicities and the American government, but what does it say about our people who have moved here from various countries for the last 50, 60 years? I want to know, and I'm sure many of you want to know, how are Muslims depicted within American history? And it's a very, very sensitive topic, as well as an interesting topic, because of the fact that we have a lot of things that have been going on for the last 15 to 20 years. And we want to know how we're actually going to be able to put that down on paper, make it partial and fair, and make sure that it's representing us to the best of the academics, performance, and standards, but also that it's giving fair representation to the Muslims. Joining me is Peter Manso, who holds a doctorate from Georgetown University and is currently curating an exhibit on American religious history for the Smithsonian Institution. He's the author of The Retelling of American History, One Nation Under Gods, The Novel Songs for the Butcher's Daughter, The Memoir Vows, and the travelogue Rag and Bone. His writing appears regularly in publications including The New York Times, as well as The Atlantic. Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me. Great to be here with you.
Hi, Peter.
Yes, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Well, apparently I can't hear you. Maybe he can hear
me
right now. It's probably because of the fact that my headphones are not up. Peter, I'm sorry about that. I can hear you pretty well now.
Okay, sorry about that.
No.
Yes, well, all you missed me saying was thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you for being on our show this evening. So I'm curious to know, and I know that you've written an article in the Huffington Post talking about who America's first Muslims were. In your research and from what you've gathered, talk to us a little about that. And I think this is a little bit fresh and interesting because of the fact that I'm assuming you're not Muslim yourself. So we're really getting some type of a perspective from the quote-unquote outside. So talk to us a little bit about what you read and what you discovered and why you decided to go ahead and put this down in an article.
Sure. I wrote about it for the Huffington Post and also around the same time wrote an op-ed about a similar subject for the New York Times. And it's a theme of the book as well, this forgotten history of Islam in America. And I wanted to make it a subject of my research because it was something, as you alluded to earlier, about the ways in which we are taught history in this nation that I never learned growing up. When I learned the history of the United States or the colonial history of the Americas, I never learned that there were Muslims involved in any way. And yet, when you begin the barest amount of research to go back and look at and see who was involved in the earliest interactions between Europe and the Americas, you find that Islam is always there. Islam is there from the very beginning. Going back to the very first moment when, if we start with Columbus, for example, which is the usual way that American history starts, you need to start with understanding that 1492, the year that Columbus famously sails the ocean blue, is also the year in which the Moors are evicted from Spain finally, after hundreds of years of war between Spanish Catholics and Spanish Muslims. And this, what happens at that point is that this tension between religious traditions in Europe is transplanted into North and South America. Mainly in the form of those who were brought against their will. The earliest history of Islam in America is also the history of slavery. Mm-hmm. The Spanish wanted to avoid bringing Muslims in as slaves because they were afraid that they would actually convert Native Americans if they happened to meet them. And yet they arrived anyway. We find them written about throughout. Documents of Spanish exploration of the Americas, we find there's this concern about Muslim influence because there are Muslims actually arriving in the Americas as early as the late 15th century.
So at that time, when these Muslims, obviously, unfortunately, in the mode of being slaves, from that angle, was there some type of a concern because of the fact that they're bringing this kind of foreign and exotic religion over to the United, to America at that time? What was the thought from the non-Muslims or the Christians or whomever were residing in that area? How did they feel about the Muslims kind of practicing their faith in a land which is obviously not Muslim in any way?
Oh, they were terrified by it. We're talking about a generation of Spanish conquistadors who grew up in the shadow of a mythology of a moment called the Reconquista, when Spanish Catholics retook Spain from Muslims as they saw it. And so this generation that grew up hearing these tales of how the Spanish Catholics had driven the Moors from the Iberian Peninsula, when they arrive in the Americas, they are in a way still fighting Islam in their minds. Mm. And so when they are encountering Native Americans, for example, when they find unusual or novel to them religious practices, if you go back and look at the language they use, the word choices they make when they write about this in Spanish, it's very Arabic-influenced Spanish that they're using. They're talking about Native Americans as if they were Muslims, in a way, and they're comparing them to the religious differences they knew from the old world, essentially, and bringing that in. And bound up with that is this fear that those they are bringing in as slaves will have a spiritual influence on this new population that mm-hmm. they are meeting.
So you bring up something which I find to be somewhat interesting, which is the history of the Native Americans in this country. Was there any type of difference when it came to approaching Native Americans as it was for the Muslim slaves? Was there some type of a discrepancy with the Native Americans in terms of saying, hey, maybe we can work this out, maybe this will work together, or we can work together, as opposed to, say, the Muslim slaves, where they were pretty much, we don't want anything to do with you, and you will not practice your faith in this country?
There's a fascinating story I tell in my book by a man who's come to be known as Mustafa Zamori. He's more often known in the historical record as Estevancio, Little Stephen. He was born in Morocco early in the 16th century, was captured by the Portuguese in 1513, and early in the 1530s he's brought to the Americas as a slave for a fated exploration that shipwrecked off the coast of Texas. He goes on to become one of the earliest great explorers of the North American continent. He traveled through Texas and New Mexico, maybe even as far north as into Kansas, in the middle of really the heartland of the country. And the fascinating thing about him is that the type of Islam with which he was raised in Morocco was very much open to syncretism, was open to blending with other traditions. And when he encounters Native Americans, he almost from the very beginning is finding a way to blend their traditions with his own. And he actually, when he eventually escapes his Spanish captors, he becomes a healer among the Zuni tribe of New Mexico, and is revered in some legends, is revered as a god for a time. And I think it has to do with the very particular way in which he was raised to practice Islam in Morocco early in the 16th century. So there is this recognition identification of different types of difference in relation to this dominant faith that's coming into the Americas at the time, to the Christian faith. And all those on the outside were finding a way to interact with it in a way that sometimes brought them together.
And with regards to how then the Muslims try to recognize the fact that there was this faith that they were bringing over to this country, was there any type of organizational disposition that these slaves were trying to make? Were they trying to formulate some way in terms of wanting to practice their religion, saying maybe we can find a place where we can pray, hold some Islamic reverence in terms of wanting to discuss the faith, preserving it? What were perhaps some of the activities that they conducted in order to go ahead and say to themselves that we need to protect our religion?
Well, you have to remember that when you're talking about the enslaved population, you're talking very often about a powerless population, and so they did not have the freedom very often to do the things that you're describing. And so you don't find that very often in accounts of Muslims among the Spanish explorers. However, when you do find in early American history and in early North American colonial history, so more English colonial history than Spanish, mm-hmm. you do find accounts of enslaved Muslims finding ways to continue their communities. You mentioned that I'm curating an exhibit for the Smithsonian, and one of the fascinating documents we're including is what is thought to be the only known Islamic legal text written in Arabic by an enslaved Muslim in America. It was written off the coast of Georgia early in the 19th century by a man named Bilali Muhammad, who, because of this the plantation he lived on was remote enough and there was enough of a concentration of other Muslims around him, they were able to maintain something of their religious identity for years. For how long, we don't exactly know. But we do know that it was enough there that he felt the need to write this legal text. Because obviously, with a religion that is so much based on your access to texts, needing to recreate it is the first step in maintaining your community in some ways. So there was enough there that he felt the need to do so, and it has survived to this day. It's in the collection of the University of Georgia, which is making it available for the Smithsonian for this exhibit. Far more often you find stories of individuals who are finding ways to continue their belief and their prayer practices in any way they are able to do so. In my book, I also write about a fellow named Omar ibn Said, who was a slave who lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He was enslaved at the age of 37 in what is now Senegal, and he had been a religious teacher in his community at home, and so, of course, he brought all this learning with him, but he was fairly isolated when he got here. And so he wrote an account of his life, again in Arabic, that explained what had happened to him, and explained as he told the story of his capture and his eventual escape once he was in the Carolinas in his recapture, he explained that eventually he came to be converted to Christianity. And yet if you read through the lines of his story, you can see that he was still maintaining his original Islamic faith as much as he was able to under the circumstances.
Right. Well, very fascinating in terms of just the actual growth and what we see now as perhaps artifacts from that time when it comes to the Islamic spirit and just the recognition of Islam at such an earlier time in American history. When we return, we'll continue our discussion with Peter Mansour with regards to the first Muslims here in the United States, but we're also going to kind of delve into a little bit about what is history and how is history written. Stay with us. We will be right back after this.
While cutting molding with a 12-inch dual compound miter saw, while holding a newborn baby in your arms, when face-to-face with a congregation of alligators, with the ball in your hands and the entire freaking season on the line.
There are a million places you'd never consider texting, so why would you do it while driving? NASCAR driver Casey Kane here, asking you to please stop the text, and together we can stop the wrecks.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Get the message at stoptextstopwrecks.org.
Radio Islam, the nation's first daily live call-in talk radio show produced by Muslims for the mainstream market. Radio Islam, on the air since 2004 because of your generosity. Radio Islam salutes its most valuable asset, you, our listener. From our producers to our interns, we appreciate your support. Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Islam, a call and talk radio program here on 1450 AM WCEV, where you can always give us a call with your questions or comments at 773-777-1450. We are talking about the first Muslims in America, and our guest tonight is Peter Mansour, who is currently the curator at the Smithsonian Institution, or I'm sorry, curating an exhibit on American religious history for the Smithsonian Institution. And we were talking before the break a little bit about the history of Islam and how it actually made its ways to the shores of America through the slaves that were brought over here way back when, a very long time ago. So, Peter, as we were discussing, and you had mentioned as well about some of the artifacts that had been, I believe they've been maintained, they've been kept by various historical institutions. Talk to me a little bit about the essence of Islam in words. So what I mean by that is really how it's been captured in books and maybe how it's not been captured in books because of the fact that the history, as we know now, has been here for quite some time. Has it really evolved, or has it faded away and obviously now resurfaced for reasons that are very much out of our control? But that being said, it's very much also a cornerstone in this country.
Yeah, it's interesting that you raise the question of how we write history. And so, of course, the way we write history is we go back and we find sources when we find that other people have written something about the subject we're interested in hundreds of years before. And so the problem with writing about Islam early in America is that these documents written by Muslims are so few and far between. We do have something like the Bilali document, as it's known, that was written off the coast of Georgia early in the 19th century. We have the autobiography of Omar ibn Said written around 1830. But beyond that, there are not very many primary source documents written by early American Muslims that we can look to and we can read and try to get a sense of how they felt themselves. And so what we're forced to do is to read others' accounts of those lives. And this isn't necessarily a dead end because we can, again, if we read between the lines of a lot of these documents, we can see a lot more of the world being rendered that may have been intended. An example is the work of a Presbyterian missionary in the middle of the 19th century. His name was Charles Culloch Jones. And he wrote a guide to evangelizing, to converting enslaved Africans on plantations in the middle of the 19th century. And he complains about this problem of the stubbornness of the religious positions of Muslim slaves. He would explain that no matter how often he would try to preach to them about Jesus, they would always continue to say, no, Muhammad, that this is how we learn about God, is through Muhammad. And so he would even complain that they would eventually seem to him to develop a kind of syncretism, which is a blending of religious traditions, often coming about for a very practical purpose. And so he would go and tell them about the gospel, and they would repeat it back to him, but clearly blending it with their own religious knowledge and their own religious experiences that were very much Islamic to the core.
So Peter, let me ask you this. Was the reason for that because of the fact that they were trying to dilute Islam in some way? Were they trying to go ahead and perhaps extract some of the theological purity from the religion so that it wasn't really presented in its wholesomeness, in its fullness?
I think that it's a little bit of both, and there is always a practical consideration, which is that their lives would become easier in many cases if they became Christians, or at least if they were known to become Christians. And so just as you could find, for example, after the reconquest of Spain by the Spanish, you would find the phenomenon of people, of Muslims who were known as Moriscos, little Moors they were called. You'd also find secret Jews in a similar way, men and women who would convert in name alone to Christianity, but then would find ways in secret of practicing their true religious perspective. And so you'd find something similar on slave plantations. When this dominant religious position was being enforced upon them, very often they would find ways of accepting it, of making peace with it. And over the course of years and generations, there becomes much more of a blending than we would expect to see today. The lines between different religious traditions in moments of crisis like that are much more porous than I think that we tend to expect.
So now, fast-forwarding ahead, in contemporary American culture, we obviously, at the turn of the century, have seen some phenomenal, extraordinary type of events which happen to pertain to Muslims in America. We obviously know about 9/11. We know, obviously, with some of the other events that have escalated over the last several years, even as of yesterday. The question then becomes, how do people curate, how do they preserve and protect what the actual history is about without necessarily taking sides, without actually being biased? What is the process behind that? And is there going to be some type of a situation where 50 years from now, the people are going to be looking at the textbooks and they're going to be seeing some distortion in terms of what actually happened, what is not being told as the truth for Muslims? And moving forward, is there going to be maybe perhaps backlash as a result of what's being written in those historical books?
I think that's the risk. That's the real danger. And I think that for many corners of this country, the history of Islam in America begins with 9/11, unfortunately. And so the job of historians is not only to go back and tell this deep centuries-old history that we've just been talking about, but to say that, well, no, in fact, there is another history of Islam in America. And it's true that Islam in America, as it was brought in among the enslaved populations from Africa, it disappeared for a time. But then it returned later in American history, much earlier than people usually suppose. For example, the first mosque known to have been built in America was built there in Chicago in 1893 for the Chicago World's Fair. It was built, in fact, as something of a tourist attraction, but the interesting thing about it is that for the World's Fair in 1893, which is a major major production building, bringing in hundreds of thousands of people from all around the world, hundreds of Muslims arrived to be part of the World's Fair as well, and they used these mosques that were built temporarily as actual places of worship.
Right.
So we find that there in Chicago in 1893. We find more permanent mosques built I believe in the 1930s, in South Dakota, in Iowa, in Maine, there is a mosque that claims a tradition going back to 1915, for example, using an old mill building. And so the job of historians is to remind Americans that all of this is part of American history. The question of Islam in America is not this a new question that we are asking and how are we to make sense of it. It is very much a part of American history as any immigrant story is, and we are enriched by it, and it's not something we are threatened by.
Speaking of how you know, these assertions are made. You know, part of the reason why I got interested in this was the fact that, you know, I want to say 5 years ago, there was a fourth grade Virginia history textbook which came out, which contained some discussion and assertions about the battalions of African-American soldiers who fought for the Confederacy during the Civil War. And it was never necessarily backed up. It was more or less a claim that was surfacing and floating around the Internet. And through that, a textbook was actually written about it, and it was actually provided in certain schools in Virginia. I find that to be somewhat asinine to some extent, but also the fact that there is so much exposure and exploitation from the perspective that anybody can grab various literature off of the Internet and then go ahead and publish a textbook. In your own opinion, with regards to how that has been approached, how can school history textbooks kind of get a better understanding, especially with new quote-unquote cultures like Muslims, like Islam in this country? And what can the American academic institution do to preserve that in an authentic way, so that we're not necessarily seeing fabrications within the words, but we're actually seeing more or less the truth of what's happening?
Yeah, there needs to be a much more comprehensive and rigorous way of talking about religion and religious difference from an early age in this country, I think. What we're seeing now is that whenever there's an effort in a U.S. high school to teach about Islam, which is vital for anyone's just understanding of global politics today, or as well as for our own history, whenever you see an effort, usually very well-meaning and often very well done, to teach about Islam, you find someone making a protest about it. We've seen it recently in Georgia. I'm speaking to you from Maryland. We saw it recently in Maryland. A single parent can make a protest, and it makes a big problem for the schools. And so I think a lot of schools end up shying away from it, unfortunately. And so I think the solution might be just to come up with a more comprehensive way to talk about religion generally, and so to not make it seem as if they are spending too much time on Islam. They are viewing it within the range of beliefs around the world, and showing them all to have histories that have been entwined for centuries, and this is how we come to the current moment, right, where we are.
Okay.
And so it takes some courage on the part of educators to do that, unfortunately, because
right,
there is this the culture of the Internet has led itself to protest against that kind of work. And that's unfortunate.
We're just about out of time, Peter, but I definitely wanted to ask you, how long will you be curating the exhibit on American religious history at the Smithsonian?
The exhibit is set to open in July of 2017.
Okay.
So it's a long process, but then the exhibit will be up for a little more than a year, I believe, at that time in Washington.
And can they get more information on it at your website?
I believe they can. They can certainly go to my website to learn about my book, and they can learn more about the exhibit at petermanseau.com.
Right. That's Peter, MANSEAU.com. Peter Manseau, thank you so much for being on our show this evening. This was a wonderful topic.
My real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Radio Islam now presents Marked in Time with historian Faraz El-Khatib.
Assalamu alaikum, and peace be upon you. Africa today is a continent rife with social and political problems. Unfortunately, what commonly comes to people's minds when they think of Africa is poverty, bad governments, and warfare. But this was not always the case. In the mid-14th century, a strong, thriving Muslim empire existed in West Africa, led by Mansa Musa. The Mali Empire had been established in the 1200s, but by the 1300s, its wealth and power, based largely on the gold and salt trade, were unmatched anywhere in the world. What really gives us an insight into the Mali Empire was the pilgrimage of its king, Mansa Musa, in 1324. His caravan consisted of over 60,000 people, many of them decked out in expensive robes and jewelry. Contemporary accounts state that 80 camels in the caravan were saddled with hundreds of pounds of gold. That gold was distributed to people all along the caravan's route to Mecca. In Egypt, Mansa Musa gave out so much gold that he inadvertently caused runaway inflation that plagued Egypt's economy for years. But perhaps more significant than his trip to Mecca was his return. Recognizing that Mali lacked the knowledge that other regions in the Muslim world had, Mansa Musa offered huge salaries to scholars who would come back to Mali with him and teach there. Scholars from Persia, Syria, Egypt, and Spain all accompanied the African king back to Mali, where many settled in the city of Timbuktu. Timbuktu soon became a center of knowledge in the Muslim world. The Sankore, Sidi Yahya, and Djengerebre universities were the intellectual powerhouses of the city. The most advanced and intelligent students from all over the world in the 1300s and 1400s journeyed to Mali to study in its famed universities and mosques, which still stand today. I'm historian Firas Al-Khatib with Marked in Time for Radio Islam. Thanks for listening. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Nas'aluka ya man huwa Allahu alladhi la ilaha illa huwa ar-Rahmanu ar-Rahim. الملك القدوس سلام المؤمن المهيمن العزيز الجبار.
Happy Ramadan and Ramadan Mubarak. Radio Islam is pleased to bring you Blessed Days, Blessed Names with the late Amina Asilmi, Allah yarhamha.
Al-Hadi,
the guide. To guide is to point out the way, to direct, the cause or motion, to give instruction, to train. A person who directs or serves as a model for another's conduct. He guides every creature to what it needs. For the few who accept his guidance completely, he gives the knowledge of his essence. We all need Allah, and we need his guidance. One of the things that I recognized about Islam almost immediately, before I even actually took Shahada, I recognized that Islam was a guide to living. It's a perfect guide to living. It's a map that's been written down, a perfect map that shows us every route, every street, every path we need to walk. It shows how to keep us safe. It shows how to keep us clear. It shows us Allah's love. Shows us Allah's mercy. It's a map written down, a gift from Allah, preserved for all times, that we would never be without guidance for even a moment of our time. He also gave us messengers, prophets, men of knowledge to remind and to teach. All of this is a part of Allah's guidance. Allah's guidance will always increase according to how much we accept.
That was the late Amina Asilmi with her reflections on Allah's 99 names. May God have mercy on her soul.
This is a rebroadcasted episode. Catch us on all social media at Radio Islam USA. Blessings be upon you. Good evening. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago, Illinois. I'm your host, Olivia Richardson. Radio Islam is a live call and talk radio program airing every day from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time and reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can tap into all of our prior shows as well. To comment on what you hear tonight, if you want to join in the discussion that we're having, then please give us a call at 312-263-ISLAM. That's 312-263-4752. And we're talking with Sheikh Hisham Al-Kaisi. He is the community coordinator at Islamic Villa Park, and he's also imam there. And we are bringing him on to talk about, I guess, Ramadan, all the wonderful, there's a lot that we're going through, I guess, from not eating, but there's also a lot spiritually that we're going through. And so he's going to talk about us with us on how to kind of sustain it and things that we can do throughout Ramadan to continue to build upon. So, Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Hisham. Thank you for joining us.
Wa alaikum assalam. Peace be unto everyone.
Wonderful. All right. So, yeah, we're kind of wanting to hear your words, I guess, on like what, now that Ramadan has started and we're kind of not quite halfway through, but it's kind of the beginning and we haven't hit like the last 10 days or anything, which is like where I feel like it gets super spiritually like interested or motivated. What can we do like now during, I guess, these days to kind of strengthen our deen and our iman?
Well, this is a great time in the blessed month of Ramadan because it's really the time when many of us as Muslims who, I would say probably almost all of us as Muslims, haven't really fasted consistently or regularly for almost an entire year. So what usually happens, and this is a sad part with regards to our entire community, that those first 5 or 6 days tend to get kind of lost. Right, because you're pretty much, you're hungry, you're sleep deprived, you know, you're basically hangry all the time. Basically, just keep your mouth shut so you don't lose your entire reward of fasting. Until about we see, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 days in, right where we are now, where people start to hit their stride, where the fasting kind of becomes normalized. And there's a wisdom behind why Allah made fasting in the month of Ramadan an entire 30 days, and didn't just make it 1 week or didn't just make it 1 weekend. Because you really wouldn't be able to discover the true spiritual strength within yourself unless you went through the entire course. If we see in the Quran how Allah describes fasting, he says, kutiba alaykum, right? Fasting was prescribed for you. And the thing about a prescription, and you ask any medical professional, if you don't follow the full course of the prescription, right, if the doctor writes you a 10-day course of antibiotics or, you know, take it 2 times a day or 3 times a day, any other alteration, you're probably not going to get the same results. The same is true with fasting, right? Allah prescribes this for us, having all of the knowledge and all of the wisdom that Allah has, knows exactly who we are, knows exactly what we need, and gives us this prescription to follow. Here before you are these 29 or 30 days. Fulfill them as I have prescribed, and you will attain something by the end of it, and that is consciousness of Allah. That is the ultimate goal of why we fast. That is the ultimate reward of our fasting by the end of this blessed month. And how to achieve it, right? Mm. Allah takes away these, or we voluntarily actually give up, for the sake of Allah, only to follow His command, things that are normally permissible for us. And in doing so, we train our bodies and we literally start to find new strength within ourselves. Once we remove the dependency on food, and we remove the dependency on water, right? You think about it, by the end of the day, hey, I didn't eat all day, I didn't drink all day, and I'm still alive. So, you know, what exactly is keeping me alive? It is the will of Allah alone. It's not necessarily the material means. And this is about the time in the month where we start recognizing that, whether it's specifically that lesson, or we at least notice, hey, something about me is a little bit different by this time. And that's a blessing from Allah.
Absolutely. So what happens if it's, I guess you kind of have gone through so far and you don't necessarily feel like, hopefully you do feel connected, but you don't necessarily feel like you're really in like, I guess like Ramadan has a certain spirit to it. So what if you don't really feel like you're there doing it yet?
There are individuals that come to me on the 29th night of Ramadan and say, I still don't feel it, right? And for those individuals, I say more power to you, right? Because the moment we feel satisfied with Ramadan, if I fasted 1 or 2 days and I said, all right, I feel spiritually comfortable, I'm connected with Allah, I'm good to go, I would have wasted the next 28 days, all right? But in reality, right, the Muslim should always be, and I don't use this term facetiously, right? We should always be hungry for more. We should always be wanting more. We should always be wanting to get closer to Allah. So for those individuals who feel like we haven't felt quite the spirit of Ramadan, haven't quite felt the connection that I'm looking for, good. That means you still have something to strive for. If you don't have a goal in mind, right, if you've already crossed the finish line, why would you still run? So the fact of the matter is that we still have something that we should try to achieve. So if you haven't felt it, don't feel down. Rather, use that as a means of encouragement to say, I can still achieve something. And for those individuals who feel like they have already felt that, know that you can still push yourself further and you can still try to achieve something in the blessed month. Ramadan as itself is a month, right? And it carries with it these blessings. But these blessings are not passively absorbed, like osmosis or something, right? Yeah. One has to go and seek them. It's an active process. So by fasting, you know, that's one active motion. By increasing an individual's acts of worship, whether it be recitation of the Qur'an or listening to the Qur'an, or praying prayers that are voluntary, or going to the masjid more than maybe you normally go to, or inviting and being more generous to people around you, and inviting people from your community, and giving dates and sweets and stuff to your neighbors, whether they're Muslim or not. These are all actions that one can do to try to absorb those blessings actively within our lives. So there's always work to be done.
Cool, cool. That's actually a really big relief that you said that. So what about, like, I think I've come up a few couple of times where I know, like, there's a saying where, like, if you are backbiting or if you're gossiping, then it's like you might as well not be fasting. What if you kind of find yourself, like, you didn't realize, unfortunately, it becomes so normal, like, oh, man, I was gossiping. Like, should you just be like, well, I guess my fast is over? Or, like, what should you do at that point?
Most definitely not. The obligation of fasting remains on an individual, okay? Whether or not it is accepted or whether or not the reward is recompensed in full, that is up to Allah. Our responsibility is to fast. So whether or not you backbite, whether or not you steal, whether or not you lie, whether or not you still perform sins in the month of Ramadan, right? An individual still has to perform the fast. Otherwise, there are other penalties that are incurred upon the individual. So you don't want to end up yourself in a bigger hole than where you started. Rather, okay, an individual who still commits sins in the month of Ramadan, as we all do, because we are human, they sometimes find despair because they hear about how the Prophet, peace be upon him, told us that the shayateen, right, Satan and the devils, they're all tied up in the month of Ramadan. That's true, but I'll give you an example. And it has to do more with residual effects. Say if you've ever been in the car with someone who smokes, all right? You don't smoke yourself, you don't want anything to do with it, but the person driving, or maybe you get into a cab and they're smoking, right? The moment you step out of the car, now you've removed yourself from that source of smell.
Yeah.
But it's still, you know, it sticks in your sweater, it's on your hair, it's in your clothes, it's, you know, you still walk around with that lingering effect of it. The effect of our sins, even in the month of Ramadan, right, by being actively involved in them all year long, they will have that lingering, you can call it secondhand smoke effect on us, even in the month of Ramadan. So while an individual usually won't engage in new sins in the month of Ramadan, there is a good possibility, unless one really strives, that he will still continue sins that he was doing outside of Ramadan. That's the blessing of Allah, is that at least you won't engage in new things. So if an individual is backbiting, if an individual is stealing, if an individual is lying or doing those non-Muslim, non-Islamic actions, one should rather look at, what am I doing the rest of the year that's causing me to do this now? I still have the obligation to fast. Whether or not it's accepted is up to Allah, and Allah loves to give more than Allah loves to take. But we have to make an effort upon ourselves on how can I reform my life. The month of Ramadan is a training ground. The rest of the year is where you're supposed to put that into practice.
Awesome. So that's actually another, like, a good, like, leeway to next topic, which is, like, how do you sort of sustain the effects of, I guess, Ramadan? Like, let's say you get into a good matter of not backbiting and fasting, being aware of what you eat. How do you kind of sustain that long term? Because I think, yeah, by the time Ramadan comes around next year, it's like fasting is like, oh, it's so difficult again. And so how do we...
Exactly.
Yeah.
The thing with actions in Islam, right, is that Allah loves those actions that are done consistently, even if they are small. So everything in the month of Ramadan is, I guess you could say, exaggerated, right? You're fasting for 30 straight days. You're praying for an hour and a half every single night. You are reading a full chapter of the Quran every single day, right? People get into, you could say it's like worship on steroids, you know, in the month of Ramadan. Now, the moment the month ends, All right. For many of us, we totally drop off. Okay. What I was fasting for an entire month, now I fast maybe once every couple of months. When I was praying an entire hour of voluntary prayers in the month of Ramadan, now I barely struggle to make my obligatory prayers. So that is not the preferred way, right? Rather, an individual uses the month of Ramadan to springboard into consistent but small actions. And that is the key, right? That it's consistent even if it's small. So while in Ramadan, okay, you want to read, you know, a full chapter of the Quran a day or a page of the Quran a day or whatever an individual is capable of doing, take that same page, all right, and break it up over a couple of days in the week outside of Ramadan. Say you were praying for, you know, 20 extra rak'at of prayer a night in the month of Ramadan. Okay, do two every other day outside of Ramadan. That, I think, is something that is doable for many of us. Or if not, look at what you're capable of doing, whether it's two rak'ah a week, right? But you do that consistently, that will build up and have a greater reward rather than the individual that jumps into the deep end and ends up drowning. Right? Yeah. You swim around in the shallow, you're going to cover a whole lot more distance.
Really, really cool. And so then, I guess Ramadan also is a time of learning as well. So, like, what are some things that we can do to, I guess, like, increase our knowledge of the deen and everything? Like, are there any specific prayers we should also do, like, besides, like, the obligatory and tarawih, but, like, any duas, I guess, anything like that?
So the month of Ramadan, yes, it definitely carries with it blessings. The best thing to do in the month of Ramadan is to connect with the Qur'an, all right? The hadith of the Prophet, peace be upon him, is there all year long, right? The history of our rich Islamic heritage is there all year long. The Qur'an was specifically revealed in the month of Ramadan, and so this month is considered the month of the Qur'an, right? Ramadan is the month of the Qur'an. So whether you are reciting the Qur'an, whether you are listening to the Qur'an, whether you want to pick up a translation or a transliteration of the Qur'an, whatever the case may be, use this month to connect yourself with the Qur'an, because there is no better way to connect with Allah, or rather to return to Allah, except from that which came from Allah himself, and that is the Qur'an, right? We consider the Qur'an to be the words of Allah. So therefore, when you read the words of Allah, you think about the words of Allah, you have the words of Allah recited upon you, whether it's on your phone or on nobody uses CD players anymore, but whatever however you want to engage with the Qur'an, do it in the month of Ramadan, whether you're listening to it or you're reading it yourself or you're reading it to others or having others read it to you or you're reading a translation, whatever the case may be, connect with the Quran. That is the best form of education in this blessed month.
Cool. All right. So we're actually going to take a really quick break. So if anyone has any questions as well for Sheikh Hisham, please feel free to give us a call at 312-263-4752. Otherwise, you can post on our Facebook page or you can post on or tweet us at Radio Islam USA, and we'll try to read those. We'll be right back.
نسألك يا من هو الله الذي لا إله إلا هو الرحمن الرحيم الملك القدوس سلام المؤمن المهيمن العزيز الجبار.
Happy Ramadan and Ramadan Mubarak. Radio Islam is pleased to bring you Blessed Days, Blessed Names, with the late Amina Asilmi, Allah yarhamha.
Dhul Jalali wal Ikram.
Allah is the Lord of Majesty and Generosity. Generosity means willingness to give. It means unselfish. Majesty is the dignity and power of a sovereign. Nothing exists without Allah. Everything depends upon him. There was nothing before him, there will be nothing after him. And Allah is generous in every way. While Allah is independent, he's tied himself to every man, and every man to other men, every creation to other creation, with invisible ropes called need. He uses each man, each creation, as a means or vehicle to give another what it needs, and the joy of hereafter. One who knows this attribute will expect nothing from man, nor does he fear their condemnation. For him a sword held to his throat is no different from gold poured at his feet. He's neither worried by the one nor overjoyed by the other, for Allah is enough. See, we all need, everyone needs something. And Allah is very generous. He provides for our needs. Sometimes what we need is brought to us by another human being, and we reject it because that human being does not meet up to our standards in some way. Allah is generosity beyond generosity. He expects us also to see to the needs of other people. Sometimes He sends us to people in need of something that we may provide it. There are times when that need will be as small as a positive word, or a hug, or an ear to listen to a problem. At other times it takes direct intervention, but Allah sends those people to solve our problems, to assist in solving our problems, and sends us to assist others in solving their problems. Allah is the most generous and teaches us to be generous. Generous with our heart, generous with our mind, generous with our action, and generous with what we possess in every way.
That was the late Amina Asilmi with her reflections on Allah's 99 names. May God have mercy on her soul.
Welcome back. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago, Illinois. We reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com. You can view all of our prior shows. Radio Islam is a call and talk show every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. If you have any questions for us in these last few minutes, please give us a call at 312-263-4752. And we are talking with Sheikh Hisham Al-Kaisi of Islamic Villa Park, Islamic Foundation Villa Park. And so we're talking about Ramadan, and I guess some of the benefits and things that we can do to sustain our, I guess, blessings and the work that we put in. So I know Ramadan is a lot about, but it certainly a benefit to it is that the good deeds that we do during Ramadan, I guess they count in the end. So what, I guess, can we do to increase our good deeds and then, like, maybe continuing those good deeds post-Ramadan?
So using the month of Ramadan, you know, we have an ability to really introspect a lot more because, like I said, a lot of the distractions that we usually partake of are set aside voluntarily for Allah. And right around this time is when we start looking into our souls, looking into ourselves, looking into our schedules, looking into our friends, looking into our lifestyles, looking into where we live and how we live, and start thinking about what kind of meaningful change can I make moving forward. You know, by the end of Ramadan, an individual would have fasted for so many days, would have prayed for so many nights, would have read so much more Quran, would have, exerted themselves in giving of charity and helping others and looking out for one another. So rather than waste all of that, think of it as an investment that can come with a massive return. But unless you direct that investment in the right place, all of your hard work will basically get lost. So what an individual can do, right, during Ramadan is to start thinking about what am I going to do outside of Ramadan. It's not too early to think about it. It's not a premature thought. You know, a lot of people think, oh, hey, Ramadan just started, right? Why am I starting to think about it ending? Believe it or not, hey, look, we're already a third of the way gone. So just as Ramadan quickly comes, Ramadan quickly goes away. And we need to use our time now to start thinking about what am I going to do? If you're not able to pray for an hour and a half a night, right, myself included, You're not able to pray for an hour and a half a night every single night throughout the year. Pick a time when you are able to pray for some moments, whether it be a weekend tahajjud before fajr, a weekend night vigil prayer, you know, before the early morning prayer, or whether it be a Wednesday night that you want to consistently devote to Allah, or whether it be a day that you want to fast, right? A weekly day that you want to fast, or every other week you want to fast a specific day, or if it's a page of the Quran that you want to try to read. Whatever you are able to do, okay, start it. Don't hesitate, just start. And the blessings of Allah will come. Don't forget that any intention that you make in the month of Ramadan can be rewarded, right? If this is what you're looking for, can be rewarded throughout the rest of the year as if you did it in Ramadan. And we've heard from the Prophet, peace be upon him, who tells us that an individual who does a voluntary action in Ramadan, it's rewarded as if it's a obligatory action. And an obligatory action is rewarded 70, that's 70, times what that action would have been done outside of Ramadan. So there's so many opportunities to bank, so many opportunities to literally cash in on the rewards from Allah for the rest of the year. This is the time to use our somber attitudes, to use our, you know, when you're hungry, you know, you're a little bit slower to react, you're not as quick to jump at things. So use that time, rather than sleeping all day, okay, use that time to start thinking, right, what can I do in my life? And if you need help, it's good to join support groups, talk to other Muslims, talk to imams, bring those things to the table and see what can I do to make myself better? What can I do to get closer to Allah? What can I do to elevate myself in this world and by the will of Allah in the next?
Awesome. And so I guess we have like 2 minutes left. So is there any like last specific advice that you wanted to give us and our listeners?
Specifically in this blessed month, right, don't go backwards. Right? Continue to strive for something and move forward. Rather than doing all of these good deeds and, you know, as we had mentioned before, you know, backbiting and stealing and lying and going about our entire... If you're going to give up the halal in Ramadan, then giving up the haram should be a no-brainer. Okay? If you're going to give up the permissible, normally permissible food, normally permissible drink, normally permissible interactions in the opposite gender, you know, if you're going to give all of that up during Ramadan, giving up that which is impermissible, right, lying and stealing and all the bad acts, giving those up should be a no-brainer. Right? So don't go backwards. Secondly, seek forgiveness from Allah. Right? This is the time, especially in these middle 10 days, our Prophet, peace be upon him, has told us that Ramadan can be portioned off into three portions. The first 10 days are to gain the mercy of Allah. The second 10 days, which we find ourselves in now, are to find the forgiveness from Allah. So use these moments to say astaghfirullah, to say I seek forgiveness from Allah for all of the sins which I have performed, which all of those sins which I am aware of, all of those sins which I am unaware of, all of those sins I performed in the daylight of the day, all of those sins I performed in the darkness of the night. Seek forgiveness from Allah for everything, whether you're aware of it, whether you're unaware of it, whether you did it purposefully, whether you did it mistakenly. Seek forgiveness and clear your slate so that when you get to those final 10 days and people start making those extra pushes to get closer to Allah and to increase their spirituality, you will find the reward of those last 10 days is pardon from hellfire. And that's really what we're all after. We want to be excused from hellfire and entered into paradise. We all ask that Allah grants us his mercy. We all ask that Allah grants us his forgiveness, and that Allah protects us in this world and protects us in the next, and that Allah is able, and that Allah elevates each and every one of us to the highest levels of spirituality that we can achieve, and that all of the benefits that we take from this month of Ramadan, that we're able to continue to use them and benefit from them throughout the rest of the year. And we pray that Allah grants us all guidance and grants us all spirituality, and that we are able to live upon Islam, we're able to die upon Islam, and that we are resurrected upon the testimony of faith, that there is no one worthy of worship but Allah, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jazakallah Khair, for like your wonderful words. I think I've learned so much within these last 30 minutes. So thank you so much. It's wonderful.
Alhamdulillah. May Allah bless you, and may Allah bless all of the producers and all of the listeners, and may Allah increase us all in knowledge and wisdom. Thank you for your time.
No problem. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Peace be unto all.
All right, you are listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM, Chicago, Illinois. We have to close off, but if you enjoyed what you heard tonight, then please feel free to go to our SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/Radio Islam USA, where you can listen, stream, download, and comment on our shows and catch replay of this one. You can also catch us on iTunes and Google Play just to make it easier for us or for you. The executive producer of Radio Islam is Abdul Malik Mujahid. Your producer today has been Olivia Richardson. Our engineer this evening is Raymond. Radio Islam is a Sound Vision Foundation production. The views expressed are the views of the host and the guest, not of the Sound Vision Foundation. I'm your host, Olivia Richardson. Join us tomorrow evening for another great show on Radio Islam. The end.